Okay, let me introduce myself. I'm Hiranya Pieris, and I'm going to do the cosmology review, and it's going to be on the physics of the cosmic microwave background. I understand in the last week you had some cosmology on the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solution. Is that right? Okay. So it's quite a leap from that to suddenly go to this topic. It's not such an easy topic to understand because there are many, many different concepts that you have to integrate in your head at the same time, and to do that in a week is very difficult. So I'm going to not go into all the gory details, and most of my lectures are going to involve a very, hopefully a beloved concept of any physicist, which is the simple harmonic oscillator, okay? So I'm going to start with a very, very simple version of that, and then keep adding little bits, and hopefully by the end of the day, you will have some idea of what we observe on the sky and how that relates to physical systems in the early universe. And okay, so just some disclaimers, because we're so short on time, things are going to be presented in a way that brings across physical principles rather than, you know, gory details. And you should work, if you're interested in this topic, you should work through the details, and I really recommend this textbook, which is from the point of view of physics rather than, say, you know, starting with general relativity and working through some maths. That's an approach I like, and I recommend that. So here's a brief overview of the week in this topic. So today, it's going to be essentially a PowerPoint lecture which tries to bring across the physical principles. And then the next three lectures will be on the blackboard. And so this will be the simple harmonic oscillator in more and more and more detail. And at the end, I will give essentially a more like a science talk about the future prospects in this field. So that will not be technical. Okay. Before we start, are there any questions? Okay, good. Right. So here's a pretty picture to start with. So we live inside a galaxy, as you may know. And we are sitting inside one of the spiral arms, and we are observing the sky around us. And it's going to pull back and go through the different wavelengths at which we can make observations. So this is just an elliptical projection of the full sky. That's a galactic plane there. It's going to go through visible, near-infrared, far-infrared, sub-millimeter. That's what the microwave sky looks like. And if you turn up the contrast by a factor of 10 to the 5, it looks like that. So of course, this is the galactic plane. It's the same thing that was showing as a plane of stars at the start. And we've removed a monopole there because, you know, if you just looked at this and you had microwave eyes, you would just see the same temperature in all directions. But when you remove that, this is 1 part in 10 to the 5 fluctuations in the early universe at about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Using a cartoon space-time diagram, this is what's going on. So there's something that happened up here. I've just called it Big Bang, but some kind of initial conditions. And then after that, the universe was very hot, and it was completely opaque to radiation. But eventually, as the universe expanded, it cooled, and the universe became transparent to light. And ever since then, this radiation from the early universe has been free streaming towards us, essentially without scattering again. So when we look at it now, we see it in the microwave because it's been redshifted, and we are seeing this so-called last scattering surface. And that's what we are observing when we look at the cosmic microwave background. So did the lecturer last week go through some kind of thermal history with you, the Saha equation? So here's a brief summary of that. So the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, decouples around recombination about 300,000 years after the initial time. And when we look at it, so this is the linear combination map from WMAP, which is the primary experiment from which a lot of information has been gleaned in the last several years, about 5 years. And this is a map from a smaller scale experiment from the ground. This is from a satellite. And so the aim of these lectures will be to find out what is the physics behind this kind of image, and what can we learn about cosmology and our universe from looking at this kind of image. So to a first order, the cosmic microwave background spectrum is a black body. It's the most perfect black body that we know of in nature, and it's much more perfect than what we can make in the lab. And it has a temperature of 2.725 Kelvin. When you first look at the higher order perturbations to this, what you see is not the 1 part in 10 to the 5 fluctuations from the early universe, but you see a dipole. Can you guess why there should be a dipole? It's because we are moving with respect to the CMB, so you see a hot spot in the direction that we are going and a cold spot behind us. And that's much bigger than the 1 part in 10 to the 5. So you got to subtract that. And then you see these intrinsic fluctuations with, for example, if you smooth the map then on a 7-degree scale, they'll be at the level of 16 microkelvin. And remember, you started with 3 Kelvin. So the dominant element in the early universe is, of course, hydrogen, and it recombines rapidly around redshift of about 1100. You know what redshifts are, right? You've been taught that. Okay, good. So before recombination, the main physical process that happens that we are concerned about here is Thomson scattering of photons of electrons. And it's very efficient before recombination. And the mean free path that a photon will travel before it scatters again is just given by, so this is Thomson scattering cross section and the number density of electrons. That quantity, the mean free path, is very short compared to the expansion time, which is that 1 over the Hubble parameter, okay? So there's lots of efficient scattering going on, and any previous anisotropy in the photon distribution gets completely erased. So after recombination, there's little chance of scattering because the universe has become neutral. And the photons free stream to us, and then they keep the imprint of whatever anisotropy they had at the last scattering surface. So that's what's going on in a very broad sense. So the optical depth back to some conformal time, eta. So have you done conformal time? Okay, good. Because I'm going to almost exclusively use conformal time in these lectures. It's much nicer to work in that for many equations. So the optical depth up to some conformal time is just an integral over this mean free path with the scale factor due to the expansion of the universe. And so that, then e to the minus tau is a probability of there having been no scattering back to some time eta. And there's this thing called the visibility function, which is the probability of last scattering at this conformal time per small interval in that. These details, you don't really have to think about that much, but you should basically remember that this tau was very high, right, at some very early time, and then drastically dropped. And the visibility function is something that peaks at redshift of about 1100, okay? So here's time, here's the visibility function. It peaks at the last scattering surface. So that's what you got to remember. And okay, so what we actually see is the temperature anisotropy is projected onto the sky. And when you project something onto a sphere, this is a very nice basis in which to expand it. And so this is the spherical harmonic basis. So it's just like Fourier transforms, right? This is if you had a plane sky, like a plane, then Fourier transform would have been really good. But because it's a spherical projection, this is a complete orthogonal basis on the full sky. And you can expand any temperature field in terms of these guys. And then you just have to know the coefficients ALM, right, that correspond to a given YLM. So under a rotation of this ALM, so this is just going from this ALM in some frame to some other frame characterized by a Wigner rotation matrix here, right? Then if you demand statistical isotropy, here's a two-point function of these ALMs. And that's been now transformed to the second frame under this rotation, right? By unitarity, this relation holds. So all the information in that two-point function can be characterized by its power spectrum, right, under this symmetry property. So for Gaussian fluctuations, that is, if all the information in here is drawn from a Gaussian distribution, then all the information in these ALMs are also in this power spectrum CLs, okay? So it's a way of compressing information. So this is an estimator for this power spectrum. So it's coming from expanding this map, and there are these ALMs, they get squared. And for each ALM, each L mode, you've been doing quantum mechanics, right? For each L mode, how many M modes are there? The answer is written on the, it's 2L plus 1, right? So for a given CL, you can measure 2L plus 1 modes that characterize that CL on the full sky, right? So that's why when you form this estimator, an estimator is something where you say, okay, I measure something, let's form something out of that, a statistic, which tells us something about an underlying theory. So you can see immediately here that when L is small, okay, you have fewer modes on the sky to measure, right? So it's not measured as accurately as if L was large. So when L equals 2, how many modes are there on the sky? Yes. So that very large scale mode is measured very poorly. Okay. So no matter how good your experiment is, you will never measure that better because we have one universe. Okay. Is that clear? This is called cosmic variance, right? And so the variance in this estimator for the CLs is given here, and it makes it clear, I hope, that even if you had a noiseless experiment, the larger scale you look, the worse it's going to be measured. Is that clear? Okay, good. Yes? But it's not an expansion on the sky, it's just a monopole temperature. So black body temperature as a function of frequency can be measured, right?
Isn't, like, if there are no higher order modes, isn't the expansion just going to be the monopole temperature?
That's right, yeah.
So you can, so you have that coefficient, like, perfectly.
Yeah, but this is the expansion of this temperature field. So the point that I'm trying to make is that, so this CL, as you'll see later, and perhaps not in my lectures, but in the next lectures, there are theories that predict what the CL are, right? But what we observe is a realization of those CLs where the ALMs are drawn from a Gaussian distribution with the variance CL. And you're trying to estimate what the CL of the underlying theory is. Okay. It's a very complex issue. And it's not even clear what it means when you have one realization of this distribution. To measure it on the sky, what can you learn about the underlying theory? These are complex philosophical issues. We can talk about them as we go on. Okay, so the measured power spectrum, so this is this CL thing that I wrote here. What's usually plotted is L plus 1 CL TT, or that means temperature order correlation divided by 2 pi. This is partly, this form of plotting, it is partly for historical reasons, partly because there's this very nice analytic expression for what should happen at very large scales, and this makes it go flat. But this is what you will see in all the plots. So this is L. So these are very large scales, right? These are very small scales. And you see this kind of shape. And these error bars, I don't know if you can see them. It's possibly a bad plot or a bad projector. But you can see that the error bars are up here are very large. So this contains both the experimental noise and the cosmic variance that I mentioned earlier. So here, even though the experimental noise is actually negligible, right, the error bars are quite large because of cosmic variance. And then you can see the first peak has been measured exquisitely well. You can barely see the error bars here. And then these other peaks are starting to be measured. So hopefully by the end of this lecture, you will get some intuition about why this thing looks the way it does. And then we'll go into the maths of it in the next three lectures. So the physics of the cosmic microwave background is controlled by the coupled Einstein-Boltzmann equations. Have you had any GR? OK, I'm not going to use GR, don't panic. what about Boltzmann equations? Have you done any dynamics or anything like that? OK, okay, great. So there are a big physical problem I'm trying to hide from you in this lecture, which is basically encapsulated here. So I already mentioned Thomson scattering. So the electrons and photons are tightly coupled by Thomson scattering in the early universe. And then, of course, the photons are then coupled to the nucleon through Coulomb scattering, because the electrons and protons are tied by the Coulomb scattering, right? And then all of these things interact with the metric. Then there are at least dark matter, which basically provide all the potential wells in which this is going to happen, and neutrinos, which provide radiation density even though they don't interact with this photon-baryon fluid. Okay, so this is the underlying cartoon picture of what's going on. You've all hopefully seen the Einstein equation before. Let me remind you what to do once you have the Einstein equation. So it relates geometry to energy, right? So as you possibly well know, g mu nu is the metric tensor. And you can think about it as a machine which takes some coordinates and transforms it into physical invariants. Once you have the g mu nu, you can calculate the Ricci tensor, which depends on the metric and its derivatives via the Christoffel symbols. And this is a very nasty, gory calculation in many cases, especially when you perturb the metric. But it's very straightforward. Once you have the metric, you can calculate these. And then you can contract the Ricci tensor to get the Ricci scalar just by this operation. And then you just form the Einstein tensor. And then if you have some physical theory of providing the energy, the stress-energy tensor, then you can just equate the two. Okay? Even though it's mathematically horrible, it's physically straightforward. So that's the operation that you do to get the perturbation equations that describe the evolution of various constituents and the metric in the early universe. So given a metric, you compute the Christoffel symbols, you form the Ricci tensor, you contract to form the Ricci scalar, you form the Einstein tensor, and finally, you equate that to the right-hand side. So I'm not going to work through this calculation for obvious reasons, because I don't want to overrun. But it is nicely laid out in Donaldson and various other places, which if you're interested, I can point you to. So we're going to talk about perturbations in the early universe. So for that, we need the perturbed FRW metric. This is the conformal Newtonian gauge. Once you form perturbations to the metric, you have to choose a gauge. A gauge is something which, to describe the background, there's no uncertainty in choosing variables usually. But you have a free choice in choosing variables that describe perturbations. Of course, at the end of the day, they must have the same physical invariance, right? So as long as your physical observables at the end of the day are the same, you have freedom in how to perturb a metric. So this is quite a nice choice, which makes some of the physics explicit. So that's the one I'm going to use. You might remember the FRW metric. So this is a scale factor, right? And this part wasn't there last week. This part wasn't there last week either, right? So it's just a small perturbation to the metric, right? And again, it's in conformal time. So metric perturbations are described by scalar potentials. And this psi is called the Newtonian potential. And this phi is called the perturbation to the spatial curvature. So this perturbed metric only describes scalar perturbations. By the decomposition theorem, scalars, vectors, and tensors evolve independently. And only scalars couple to matter, to density perturbations. Yes?
So what exactly do you mean by scalar, vector, and tensor perturbations?
So scalar perturbations are things that can be described by just a number, right? Tensor perturbations are things like gravitational waves, right, which I will describe very briefly later in the lecture. Vector perturbations, for the purpose of the early universe, you can just ignore them, right? So things that can be described as or transform as scalars, vectors, and tensors evolve independently.
So like if you have the gene medium, it's the FRW metric. Mm-hmm. So that solves the Einstein equation. So mm-hmm. So if you want to perturb that mm-hmm. by a scalar, do you mm-hmm. add like a scalar function times like delta mu?
So this is the way that I perturb the metric to include a scalar perturbation. These are scalars.
Okay.
So these are just potentials, right? And they're perturbations to the local metric in which the photon baryon fluid will evolve. And because we want to basically understand how density perturbations evolve, and densities can be described as scalars, we will care about this one and this one. And I don't have time to prove it, but it is possible to prove, or at least you know, it's much easier to demonstrate to yourself with an example, that if you had a tensor perturbation in the early universe, it doesn't couple to the scalar. So you can treat it separately. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry. It's a subtle point again that I don't have time to go into. But Donaldson does have a nice description of this with an example. So we had the Einstein-Boltzmann equation. So this is a Boltzmann equation. Unfortunately, you cannot describe photons and neutrinos just by one differential equation. You have to have a hierarchy of differential equations, which describe their distribution functions in phase space, right? And the distribution of photons and neutrinos move in phase space as a function of time and space, right? So you can only describe them statistically, in a sense. So maybe did somebody go through with you the Einstein, the Bose-Einstein and the Fermi-Dirac distributions? So those are the zeroth order distribution functions that describe things like this. Okay. So what we need is a perturbed version of that. So if you have a distribution function f, right, the time derivative of that is equal to all the possible collision terms. And collision terms means how different kinds of distributions interact with other kinds of distributions. I realize that this is very hand-wavy, but just trust me that this is not worth working through in detail. We want to get to the physics. Yes.
Perturbed of the Bose-Einstein and Fermi-Dirac, aren't they like exact?
It's for the background distribution exact, but we need to know how perturbations to the photons and the neutrinos interact with perturbations to the metric and the perturbations to the dark matter. It's essentially a huge set of coupled differential equations where you have to think about the monopole, the dipole, the quadrupole, the octupole, all of those of the perturbation. So the collision terms due to Thomson or Coulomb scattering need to be computed for all of these species except for the cold dark matter, because cold dark matter, of course, as you might remember, does not interact as follows. Okay, so that's kind of the thing I'm going to now draw a veil over, because I don't have time to work through all of that. And now I want to get to the temperature anisotropies, which is going to lead us to something we can observe. Okay, let's see. 24 minutes. Okay, so on degree scales, so you know that funny function I showed you like this. The first peak of that is roughly at degree scales, okay? So at that, the scattering time is very short compared to the wavelength of the fluctuations. And the local temperature at last scattering is just a uniform monopole plus a dipole, which is given by the local peculiar velocities of the baryons. This E is just a direction vector, okay? So the observed temperature anisotropy is a snapshot of this object at last scattering, but modified by gravity, right? So imagine that there is a lot of dark matter. You learned about dark matter, right? There's a lot of dark matter in the early universe, right? And most of the gravitational potential wells are supplied by dark matter perturbations, okay? So you have the temperature monopole, at some epoch R, this is the temperature monopole plus this is the scalar potential. Remember the Newtonian potential? Sorry. That object there. Is the temperature at last scattering, the star's last scattering, plus, so imagine that you're a photon baryon fluid and you're staying inside a potential well, right? To get a photon out of there to us, it has to climb out of the potential well. What happens when it does that? It redshifts. Good. So actually it turns out that this redshifting part is extremely important. And if you are in a potential well and you have photon baryon fluid, will you be hotter inside there than when you're outside? What do you think? Hotter or colder? Hotter, right? It's compressed, so it's hotter, right? However, this redshifting effect of climbing out is actually far more dominant than the fact that you were compressed while you were in the potential well. So, in fact, it turns out that when you observe a cold spot on the sky, that means that you were originally inside an overdensity, not an underdensity. It's counterintuitive, but it is the case. So your initial temperature, the redshift of climbing out of the potential well, and this is the Doppler effect, it's just the local peculiar velocities of the baryon fluid. And this is going to appear occasionally through the lectures. It's the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. What you see here, remember these are the two scalar potentials that were perturbations to the metric. It's their time derivatives, right? So if potentials are not changing, as the photons travel to us, then this term would be obviously zero, right? So if there's something that's making potentials change as a function of time, you get a contribution from that. So essentially, this is called the Sachs-Wolfe source, and that is all of these quite simple physical effects that I just described. Okay? And if only this slide will change. Yes. So that's in spatial terms. What we see is the angular projection, which I briefly mentioned before. So imagine that there's some potential, which is a function of space, and you see it at last scattering, okay? And you want to project it onto the sphere, right? So this is, to cut a long story short, this is the way that the projection happens. You have a potential, which is expanded in Lm, right? And this is the spatial part you started with. Okay, this is a spherical Bessel function. And these are the wire lengths, right? This is the basis function in which you're expanding. And so this spherical Bessel function, so this is the K mode that you started with. And delta eta is the distance to the last scattering surface. So this thing peaks when this K delta eta is roughly L. Yes?
So you're saying the photon baryon fluid. So when you look at the CMB, it's not just photons, it's baryons as well?
When you look at the CMB, it's obviously just photons. But because the photons are tightly coupled to the baryons, all the physics that you're seeing is coming from Thomson scattering. I'm going to go through it in much greater detail than this. But
why are the peculiar velocities of the baryons making a difference?
Because the peculiar velocities of the baryons are coupled to the photon perturbation as well. So there's a velocity term for the photons that come from that. And of course, that affects their temperature distribution. So you have this wave number, some k, right? And you have the distance to the last scattering surface. So this is just a projection quantity. And that's roughly equal to L because this object peaks at L. But it's not a one-to-one mapping. There's power from different Ls that contributes, power from different wave numbers than just this k that contribute to a given L. Okay, so just to show that in a pictorial way, here is K and here is L, right? So this is the physical wave number, which is then, of course, related to some underlying physical theory. And this is the projection of it that you see on the sky. Let's just focus on this top panel because that's the temperature. I'm not going to really talk that much about polarization. So you can see this is L equals 2, this is L equals 10, this is L equals 100. So very, very large scale still, right? We haven't reached the first peak of that distribution that we saw before. But you can see here, I hope, that for a given L, you're getting power from many different K. Okay? So this is a transfer function which has obscured the mapping between K, which is hopefully where theories of the early universe live, to what we observe. And this is something that we have to deal with when doing the data analysis to try and compare the theory to observations. So one of the things that I've set for you in the problem sets, and it's really the only problem that I care you do. I don't know whether I'm going to get into trouble with the tutors for saying that. I gave you four problems. Three are just bookwork. The last one is what I care that you do. And it involves taking a code which computes this transfer function for you, given some physical quantities about the universe. So we can go over that more later. Okay, so here's a cartoon picture of what's happening at different scales in that plot that I showed. So the last scattering surface is a snapshot of the photon baryon fluid. And on very large scales, is there some chalk? It's helpful to have the funny wiggly picture here. Something like this, right? So at these very large scales, you're basically seeing the primordial ripples, and these are usually, purely general relativistic effects. And it has a relation to this integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that I mentioned, which is when the potentials change. So we will go through that later. On intermediate scales, like here, what we're seeing is a battle between the radiation pressure of the photons and gravitational compression of the dark matter potential wells. So as we will see in a short time, the balance between these two things, which as you can hopefully see is opposing, pressure tends to make things expand, gravity tends to make things compress, it sets up sound waves in the photon baryon fluid, and they stop oscillating at recombination, and you basically see a snapshot of each K mode, where it was in the compression or expansion at last scattering. So smaller than the photon mean free path, that's here. You can see this is dying out, right? You get the perturbations to be exponentially damped by photon diffusion. Again, we will deal with this in detail. So that first peak you see is essentially the horizon size at last scattering surface. It's a fundamental mode, which was at the maximum of its compression at the last scattering surface. So here's your first encounter with the simple harmonic oscillator analogy, which I'm afraid you're going to see for many lectures to come. OK. So this should be a very familiar equation, right? It's a simple harmonic oscillator with a force constant k and some external force F naught. So this is x as a function of time, and this is x squared. And you can think about this one as the evolution of each individual mode, and this as its power spectrum, OK? So as you go to, so imagine that you have no force here. What do you get? You just get the homogeneous solution, right? And then if you put the boundary condition that the oscillator is initially at rest, you just get a cosine mode, right? When you add external force like this, you get a particular solution, right? OK. And then you have this omega, which is just an angular frequency, right? And the angular frequency is related to this force constant as this, right? So when you have an external force, what does it do? It displaces the zero point in the direction of the external force. So if the external force is that way, it displaces it, right? So if you had this, which is just the homogeneous solution, and you squared it, you get something that looks like that, right? When you added the external force, you get something that looks like this or like that, right? So it enforces a disparity between even peaks and odd peaks. Can you see that? OK. So it makes the odd peaks higher and the even peaks lower when you change the angular frequency, essentially. Right? Can you see that? OK. So the even peaks correspond to negative x, right? So here's the even peaks correspond to negative x. So how to make an analogy of this to the CMB? So remember our cartoon picture of gravitational instability. So here's another way of writing it, right? So delta is some perturbation to a density. And there's a battle between pressure and gravity, right? And when these two things are roughly comparable, oscillations are set up. And there's the oscillator analogy, where there's a perturbation to something that looks like a photon temperature. And there's k squared, which is an angular frequency or a wave number, or a sound speed as well here, and then external force. The force is due to gravity, and this cs squared is the sound speed of the entire photon baryon fluid. Okay, when you add more baryons to this, the sound speed goes down, the frequency goes down, and you see what happens when the frequency goes down? It makes this disparity between the odd and even peaks greater. Okay. So adding more baryons to this system should, in this cartoon analogy, suppress the even peaks compared to the odd peaks. Is that clear? OK. So the modes enter the horizon, and they start to oscillate. So outside the horizon, of course, there's no causal contact. They're constant. They enter the horizon. They feel the physics. They start to oscillate, right? And you see their phases frozen at recombination when they stop oscillating. And the peaks are maximum amplitudes. And the first peak, for example, is the first maximum compression. OK, you can see that it's a compression because, remember, the force is gravity, right? Gravity makes things compress. The first amplitude you should see that's in the direction of the force is a compressional peak. So compression, rarefaction, compression, rarefaction. So we've explained something about, or hopefully got some intuition about, the fact that there are peaks, and that the first and second peaks are different in amplitude. We haven't said anything about why they damped out. So in analogy to that cartoon picture, this is a real version of the oscillator equation containing some of the same things. So the previous picture didn't say anything about expanding universes. So there is an expanding universe. So that's the Hubble parameter for the expanding universe that's appeared there. That acts, what does this look like? This looks like a friction term, no? Right? So there's Hubble drag. It's called Hubble friction, Hubble drag, the same thing. And this R that's appearing everywhere is the ratio of the baryon density to the photon density. And do you remember from last week how radiation scales with scale factor? What is it? A to the power 4? Good. Huh? Okay, so you're thinking of an individual photon. I'm saying a photon density, right? So there's the three dimensions and then the scaling of the radius. So it's 4 for a photon density. You're right about an individual photon whose wavelength is stretching. And what about just a box of rocks, baryons? Say cube, right? Or inverse. So therefore, when you take the ratio of this, you get an A. So this thing is very important. We're going to see it again. So remember this R. And can anybody guess what is the actual photon to baryon ratio in the early universe? Is it very large? Is it very small? Is it comparable? How many photons are there to each baryon? A lot of photons, right? So this is the baryon to photon ratio. So this is small, very small, right? It's like 10 to the minus 9, right? Okay. So what does that tell you about this term? Okay, so we're trying to figure out, is this term, which appears in the wave equation, remember that k squared, cs squared, that's essentially that thing, right? So is this large or small compared to this, right? Remember there's an r here, and it is small. So that's good, right? Because otherwise, if this term was very small compared to that one, whatever was here would just damp out, right? Instead, this is big, this is small because R is small, and we get oscillations set up, right? And on the right-hand side, remember, before that, I had this cartoon thing called gravity, and so these are the forcing terms that relate to gravity. You might see the various potentials appearing. There's a redshifting term. There's a term related to the expansion. And there's an infall term. See its opposite sign. Because, you know, matter also collapses into gravitational potential wells. So that's the grown-up version. Yes?
Just comes from the Einstein equation.
Yes, so remember that stuff I showed you as a cartoon at the start and then drew a cover over? Okay, so you have to perturb the metric. You have to go through the whole Einstein operation and get equations for the potentials. You have to solve the collisional Boltzmann equations using the fact that you have these metrics as well. And you get this enormous set of coupled differential equations, right? And then you work through them and you find out that, so they're all coupled to each other, and then you find out that the one that describes photons looks like this.
Are like functions you've already solved for some other way?
You haven't, well, you haven't solved for them, you have to solve them simultaneously with this lot. And there are some physics that allows you to make substitutions, so a lot of those equations either drop out, or the initial conditions at least can be described in terms of one equation. So yes, these things relate to the metric. The two functions that appeared in the conformal Newtonian gauge are exactly these things. They're time dependent, they're space dependent. You have to describe the space dependence statistically, the time dependence using the FRW equations. Okay? So that's exactly right. So there's a huge machinery that's hidden behind this simple equation. And at the start, when people were first working out this stuff, they didn't realize this. So they had the huge set of differential equations. They chucked it into a computer and got nice graphs out like that. And it took a long time before people really understood what is the essential physics, and it was able to encapsulate it that way. And the reason that I'm giving you a homework problem, which you can run a program for 30 seconds to output one of those, and not months on a supercomputer, is that these kind of physical arguments made the actual computation of things very clear. So you have this lot, and then you have to do a WKB solution of that. Have you done WKB? If not, forget it. It's just like the simple harmonic oscillator. So you have two homogeneous solutions there. And you can see the angular frequency appearing here. There's the K, the wave number of the mode. And RS is a sound speed, okay? Pardon me, a sound horizon. Okay, so given a certain R, which is this R, the ratio of the baryon density to the photon density, sound speed is the distance that the sound horizon, sorry, not the sound speed, is the distance that sound has traveled by conformal time eta. And the sound speed is just given by this simple expression here. Right. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. I think I've talked for 50 minutes. How much time do I really have? Given that the previous guy went over by. Okay. So I promise you that the next three lectures I will probably underdo, right? So let's just get through this because it's all the physics and it's good to have it in the mind when you come to tomorrow. So this potential that I've described before, the perturbation to the FRW metric, you can see it's a function of wave number and also of conformal time. And here is conformal time, okay? So this is how this potential evolves for different wave numbers as a function of conformal time. Just ignore the blue curve. So k equals, so have you heard of megaparsecs? Okay, it's an astronomical unit and it's very large. So when wave number is 0.001 inverse megaparsecs, how does it compare to 0.1 inverse megaparsecs? Are these larger scales or smaller scales? Come on, brain. Larger scales? Which one is larger scales? Yes. Okay. So this is a very large scale. It's almost comparable to the current horizon, okay? And it enters the horizon almost, you know, very, very into the matter domination regime. Okay, so this is conformal time, right? So at some point, this is matter radiation equality. See that? This eta star is recombination. So the universe expands, photons redshift away. At some point, matter starts to dominate. And quite soon after that, the universe recombines, right? No reason. It's just how it works out with the balance of radiation and baryons in our universe. It didn't have to be the same. And in fact, we can explore later what happens if you pump up the matter density, for example, so that this is earlier. Okay? So it just happens, right? It's not identical, as you can see. The main point I want to raise is that it's quite possible in your previous lectures this was treated as these things happen instantaneously, because that's easier to solve equations. However, that's not the case. So by recombination, there's still some radiation density present. Okay? So what we want to say, without explanation, I guess, because I haven't explained where these different perturbations at different wave numbers came from, and that will be left for the next lecturer. Just imagine that there are perturbations at all wavelengths, and this one is just entering the horizon. So that's very deep into matter domination. The point here is that the potential is constant when matter dominates. If matter is not dominating and there's some radiation density around, during which perturbations do not grow, you basically dilute the potential. It's just like you have some potential, there's nothing making it grow, it just redshifts away. Okay? So here's a mode, which is k of 0.01, which came into the horizon just after matter radiation equality. And still, there was some radiation around. And you can see the potential drops for that one. It's only about 10%, but it still drops a bit. This is a mode that entered the horizon well before matter radiation equality, when radiation dominated. It drops drastically. It decays. But at all times, they all become constant. Sorry, at late times, they all become constant because here matter dominates again. But anything that entered when radiation was around suffers a drop. Okay, so this is one of the points about when a mode entered the horizon and how it relates to that plot there. You have a question? No? Okay. Okay, so that's what happens to the potential. And here's what's happened to individual density perturbation modes. Okay, so here's delta gamma. I'm sorry about the quality of the plot. Delta gamma, forget the divided by 4, plus the potential, right? So this is that Saxwell source I mentioned, the photon perturbation, and redshifting as it climbs out of the potential. So that mode, you can see it for the same three, or perhaps not the same three. What did I have previously? Oh, sorry, anyway, whatever. You have three modes of different wave number, right? And this is, again, the very small one, so it's very large scales, and this is very small scales. And again, we have eta, the conformal time. And you can see that they are, so this is recombination, right? So they're coming into the horizon, they're oscillating, right? And what you see is where were they in their oscillation at this time? Do you see that? These things are a function of time, they're oscillating, and you see them frozen here, yeah? Here's the velocity mode. This is the thing you were asking about earlier. And the velocity mode is out of phase with the density mode, right? So you can see that, for example, if you focus on this one, the purple one, where there's a minimum here, there's a maximum there. They're out of phase. And so you get a contribution from this mode as well to your power spectrum, but it will be out of phase with the other one. And remember, we had our simplistic harmonic oscillators where you were supposed to see these minima, right? And we know from the plot I showed you, hopefully, that there is no zero in the observed power spectrum. Part of the reason for that is that they get filled in by the out of phase velocity mode, which is lower in amplitude but still present. So what have I got here? Okay, so then you have some amplitude, unnormalized amplitude here. This is k, the wave number. So what I've done here is to make plots like this for many, many, many different wave numbers, and just to translate, look at the amplitude here and translate it into an amplitude plot here. Is that clear what I've done? Okay, so you can see that, you know, this guy, this is the density mode, you know, at each individual wave number, you are seeing a different wave number captured in a different part of its oscillation, right? I realize this is a bit confusing concept, but do you get the feel for what's going on there? So there's something that's oscillating in time. You see it at a certain part of its oscillation. The certain part of its oscillation is different for different wave numbers. When you add them all together, you see something like this. And there's a velocity as well, and they add. Okay? So it's something like that. And at the end of the day, after doing a whole bunch of calculations like that, you get this kind of plot, which is the theory version of the observational plot that I showed you earlier. So this is L, the multipole. That's that same LL plus 1 CL. Okay. So the Sachs-Wolf is essentially this density mode. Woo. So that's this guy. And Doppler is the velocity mode, right? It's kind of anti-correlated with this one. It's out of phase. Pardon me. So it's filled in some of the zeros. And ISW is this integrated Sachs-Wolf effect. That's the one that I mentioned, that if potentials change as photons pass through them, then you get an effect. So just to explain in a very hand-waving way what happens. So if you have a photon going into a potential well and climbing it out, and the potential doesn't change as it does that, the input blue shift is canceled by the outgoing red shift, right? Okay. So what happens if the potential shrinks as it goes through like that? So the input blue shift is not canceled by the outgoing red shift. You have a resultant red shift, and also that's one of them. And then there's also the fact that as the potential shrinks, the wavelength shrinks, and it's again a blue shift. And those two effects are equal, and they add. And it's called integrated Sachs-Wolf effect. So anytime you get the decay of potentials in the early universe or even in the late universe, you get this effect. So in the early universe, I mentioned that matter radiation equality and recombination are quite close together. So there's some radiation density around that causes potentials to decay. And most of this effect is coming from that. The second effect, did you hear about dark energy? So dark energy also leads to the same effect. So that causes an effect at very large scales because that's a projected a set of wave numbers from seeing the late universe, right? So all of these things add and give something that looks like this. Blah, blah, blah. I will go through this in infinite detail, so I'll just skip that. So what haven't we explained really about this picture? It's this damping tail here, right? We haven't said anything about that. So it's actually quite easy to understand. It's the fact that so I've acted so far as if the photons and baryons are tightly coupled together. So a photon scatters here, and zero time later it scatters there, right? It's not true, actually. The photons can diffuse a little bit before they rescatter, right? And because they can diffuse, that's called the mean free path, they basically erase fluctuations in the little bit that they were able to wander around in a random walk, right? So that effect leads to a diffusion length, which is defined as here. And this is, remember, tau, the optical depth. So that's the derivative of that integrated up to last scattering. That's the distance they were able to diffuse by a random walk, okay? So that leads to this damping length. And it's related, as you can imagine, to the baryon density. Are things like this something you've encountered before, these omegas, omega baryon h square, omega matter h square?
H is
Okay, I'm sorry. If this is complete, then forget about it. All I want to say is that the physical idea is that if there's more baryons around, okay, there should be more electrons around, right? More atoms, more electrons. Scattering rate goes up, right? Mean free path should go down. So if there's more baryons, where do you expect this damping to start? Okay, so here's this damping, right? It's exponentially damped here. Otherwise, you would get this. So if I add more baryons to this system, which way should this damping go? You have more electrons around. So the number of the mean free path between the scatterings should decrease. So damping should, so these are larger scales, these are smaller scales. Sorry, it is a very complex thing. Okay, so these are larger scales, these are smaller scales, right? If there are more electrons around, you should be able to go a shorter distance before scattering again. So the damping tail goes this way. So you should be able to see more structure before you get damped. Okay. Very nearly done. It's 1 hour now. I won't take that much longer. Okay. So I'm actually going to just ignore that. And this is the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which I just explained there. So gravitational waves. OK, I didn't explain tensor modes. I'm not going to explain polarization, I'm sorry. It's an advanced topic anyway. Just know that the CMB is polarized. OK. Maybe I will explain gravitational waves because the guy next week might say something about it. So, sorry? Okay. Okay, so gravitational waves. So everything so far has been scalar quantities, right? Scalars, density. There are theories of the early universe which predict the existence of gravitational waves. Actually, I want to go through this because a lot of the talk on Friday will be about can we find these gravitational waves. They're an incredibly powerful signature from early universe physics at energy scales that we would never, you know, capture in a particle-based accelerator on the Earth. So it's a very important signature. So gravitational waves are tensor-metric perturbations, okay? So this, again, relates to your question earlier. So you could have tensor perturbations to the spectrum, and before you saw, for example, that there was a scalar potential here, 1 plus 2 psi, there was a 1 plus 2 phi here. So now we have a tensor perturbation to the metric, and this thing obeys a wave equation. Okay, it's just a wave equation. It's actually much, much simpler to solve than the density version. So it's worth working through this yourself because it doesn't, of course, couple to things like neutrinos and whatnot. So you can actually solve this analytically. And you can get two solutions for the homogeneous equation. And it's essentially there's a H dot that comes from contracting this guy. And it is a scalar amplitude. It has two polarizations. There's H double dot. And there's a two Hubble parameter H dot, which is Hubble damping. And then there is the usual wave number term. And that's equal to zero because there's no forcing term. So it's very easy to solve this. There's a whole section on Donaldson on this. So if you're interested, just work through it. So I mentioned that the only term that really plays a role in this is this Hubble damping term. So basically, this Hij, the moment it enters the horizon, just redshifts away, right? So if you have a gravitational wave mode, and it entered a very long time ago into the horizon, say during matter radiation equality or something, it's basically completely redshifted away by now. So we only see things that enter the horizon recently. So you can see this mode, for example. It has, here is where it's entered the horizon. It's outside the horizon constant, enters the horizon. And if it evolves sufficiently and it entered sufficiently early, it just damps away. All these oscillations here arise from the transfer function. Yes? Right. So you have, okay, I don't want to talk about inflation. Imagine that the horizon is the region in space-time where causal physics operates, where light has had time to travel to us. Okay? So for some reason, which I'm certainly not going to explain today, there are perturbations that exist outside the horizon, and they have been caused and put there by a causal process, right? So outside the horizon, they're constant because no causal physics operates, and each wave number k has some amplitude associated with it, right? And this wave number then comes inside the horizon because the current horizon is expanding because light is traveling further and further out as time progresses. So it comes into the horizon and then immediately it feels the causal physics and starts to act in a way that's determined by the causal physics. In this particular case, what it feels is a Hubble drag and it damps away. Right? So this is a very, very difficult problem. Where did these perturbations come from in the early universe? And there are various theories to explain it. And one of those theories predicts that, you know, some aspects of one of those theories predicts that there should be these tensor perturbations. It also predicts what level they should be at, roughly. So this is why people are trying to observe this, to try and get a handle on why should there be perturbations in the universe in the first place. We know they are there. We wouldn't be here if there weren't any perturbations in the universe. We see an imprint of that at 300,000 years by looking at the CMB. So very important question. And maybe on the last day I will say a bit more about this. Yes?
I didn't understand what you mean by it comes into the horizon and then feels the causal physics, because that horizon is purely a function of where we happen to be. If we go a few hundred thousand light years in one direction, then our causal horizon will shift.
It's not our causal horizon that I'm talking about. It's the causal horizon at the time that it entered the horizon. It's a function of time. So there are very large scale modes which are entering the horizon just now, and they will feel the same causal horizon as we do. But much earlier on in the history of the universe, the causal horizon was much smaller, right? So something could have entered the matter radiation, something could have entered the causal horizon during matter radiation equality, and it felt, and that the size is set by the horizon at that time.
What my question is any causal horizon is a function of what point it is. It's a sphere around a given point.
Don't think about yourself at the center of anything.
not myself. But how else do you define a causal horizon? What gives a causal horizon its physical reality?
So all we can actually see is our causal horizon,
yes,
as a function of time.
Yes.
So it is quite plausible that, so imagine that, I keep coming to inflation. Sorry. Imagine that there's a huge patch outside our observable horizon where the power spectrum has been set.
It's time for us to stop.
Oh, okay.
Because otherwise the students will have difficulties having lunch.
Okay. All right. In fact, I will stop.
I just pushed down the hammer.
No foundations today.
Yeah.
It's really other stuff.